हरे कृष्ण सार्थ्यम अर्जुन स्योदं कुर्वन्गीतामृतं ददं लोकत्रयोपकाराय तस्मै कृष्णात्मने नमः। हरे कृष्ण, वेलकम बैक टू द भगवद गीता क्लास। वी आर डिस्कसिंग ऑन द सेकंड चैप्टर ऑफ द भगवद गीता वेयर कृष्णा इज रिस्पोंडिंग टू अर्जुनास वेरियस आर्ग्यूमेंट्स। सो द फर्स्ट आर्ग्यूमेंट वाज अबाउट compassion, how can I kill my relatives? So Krishna is responding from 2.11 to 2.30 by saying that actually your relatives are souls who are indestructible and their bodies are unavoidably destructible. Therefore, do not give up your duty. That's the crux of the argument. And Krishna is essentially using the strategy of naiti naiti, not this, not this, to explain the soul by negation of the material, so that some indication of the spiritual will be given, will be conveyed. So now let us look at the process by which the soul moves from one body to another body. Vasamsi jirnani tha vihaya navani krihnati naro parani tatha sharirani vihaya jirnani anyani sanyati navani dehi. So vasamsi jirnani. Vasamsi is dress. Jirnani is when they become old. Yatha vihaya. Vihaya is to give up. So just as a person gives up old garments, navani new grahanati. Nar aparani, another human being takes another garment which are new. Tatha sharirani. Similarly the body vihaya jirnani, when old is given up. And anyani sanyati is accepted new, navani dehi, the occupier of the body, the soul. So here essentially the process of transmigration is being described. So now generally we talk about, we use the words reincarnation and transmigration interchangeably. So are the two exactly the same? Not necessarily. The emphasis is different. In transmigration, the focus is on the journey. So as we hear the word migration, so birds migrate when the seasons change, or when there are, say, some natural calamities, people migrate from one place to another. So migrate is basically travel. So transmigration talks about the travel of the soul. From trans means across. So from one body to another body. So in transmigration, the focus is on the journey aspect. So the transmigration of the soul through 8.4 million species. There the word, we will use the word transmigration. Whereas in reincarnation, the focus is on coming into flesh. So as we discussed earlier, incarnation means to come in flesh. So reincarnation means to come in flesh again. So in reincarnation, the focus is on coming into a body, whereas in transmigration, the focus is on the going from one body to another body. Now, this word, there in the philosophical terms, there is also a word metempsychosis, which also refers to the journey of the soul. So there are different words, but the essential point is that life does not begin with birth and life does not end with death. So what happens thereafter, that is conveyed through an example in this verse. So this example is used to convey the point of how the body is peripheral and superficial to the soul. Now, when we are wearing a dress, our dress is important to us. But at the same time, we don't have a permanent relationship with the dress. I'll wear a dress today, and after it gets old, I'll change to another dress. So the essential person is different from the dress. Similarly, if we consider the body to be a dress, then the essential person is different from the body. And then the different bodies are like different dresses which serve different purposes. So we wear different dresses based on what we are going to do. If somebody is going to the polar areas, then people may wear warm clothes, like wool and other things. If people are going to work, they may wear a particular kind of clothes. If they're going to a formal occasion, a party, they may wear a tie and a coat or some other formal attire. So depending on the purpose that is to be served, then and accordingly the inclinations that we have, we choose a dress. So when but the essential point is that we and the dress are different. We remain the same whether the dress keeps changing. So similarly, the soul remains the same whether the dress changes. Now when the dress changes, the person, what does the person do? The person discards the old dress and takes the new dress. Similarly, if you look at the process of reincarnation, there are three stages in it. The first stage is the soul leaves the body. The second stage is the soul goes to the stage where the next body is. And the third stage is the soul enters into a situation where it will get a next body. Or the soul acquires a next body. So for example, if a person has done karma by which the person is going to say again be reborn as a human being, the first stage would be giving up the old dress. So the person gives up the body. And then after that, under the guidance of the super soul, the person travels to the next body. And this is also arranged by various factors. And finally, the soul acquires a new body. So if it's a human body, in the third canto in the teachings of Kapila, it is described that karmana daiva netrena jantur deho papattaye umsare takana ashrayaha sriya pravishta udaram pumsakre pumsare takana ashrayaha. So karmana daiva netrena, under the supervision of daiva netra, the divine eye. This is referring to the arrangement of destiny. Karmana daiva netrena jantur deho papattaye. The living entity gets a deha upapattaye. The living entity gets a body. And what kind of body will it be? How does it get the body? So, pravishta striya udaram. So, the soul enters into the womb of a woman. How? Pumsaha retakana ashrayaha. By taking shelter of a particle of semen in a male. Pumsaha retakana ashrayaha. So now, the essential point is that when the procreational act happens, at that time, the soul is in the semen and from the it's in the sperm. And then through the sperm, the soul enters into the egg. The zygote is formed, the embryo is formed, and then a child is born. So now, in these three stages, the first stage is the soul leaves the body. Now, how does the soul leave the body? Generally, it leaves through one of the nine holes. So, of course, the soul has the power to break through and also go. But generally, the soul leaves through one of the nine holes. So, generally, in the Upanishads, it said that the soul, if it leaves through one of the lower holes, then that is considered an auspicious departure. The soul is going towards one of the lower destinations, lower species, lower planets. If the soul leaves through one of the upper holes, then it's considered auspicious. So, the eyes, the ears, even the nose, the mouth. The realized yogis who attain samadhi, they aim that actually when the soul leaves, they will burst the skull and go out. And if they go out that way, then they will attain liberation. That's the understanding. So, of course, now for most of us, we don't have such awareness of the soul, and we don't seem to have any control over how the soul will leave the body. So, it's not so important for us. The most important thing is that we remember Krishna. In the 8th chapter, Krishna will talk about this. And he says, Naite suti partha janan yogi muhyati kaschana tasmat sarveshu kaleshu yoga yukto bhava arjuna. So, he says there are many ways by which Krishna has, in the previous verse, talked about the two different ways, Devyan and Pitrayan. We'll discuss about them in the 8th chapter. But then essentially, Krishna says, don't worry about all this. Just practice yoga. And it's already earlier mentioned that the best yoga is bhakti yoga. He mentioned this in 6.47 as well as 8.14. So, as devotees, we don't have to bother from which hole the soul is leaving the body. We have to bother whether we are remembering Krishna or not. So, now the soul leaves the body, and generally the soul goes to the next body depending on the karma, the two factors, the karma and the karma. Karma is the desire and karma is the destiny, what kind of karmic destiny one has got. So just as when we want to purchase a new dress, we look at what is my desire and then what is my budget. So similarly, all of us have a karmic budget, and accordingly the soul gets a new body. So we are actually dressed for and dressed by our desires. That means we are dressed for our desires means that actually, say, if a male is attracted to a female is attracted to a male, then if a male dies thinking of the female, then the male will get a new body in the next life, which will be a female body. Or a female dies thinking of the male, then the female will get a male body. If a human being dies thinking of a pet dog, and the pet dog dies thinking of its master, then both of them may well interchange their positions on the rope, on the ledge. The dog may become the master and the master may become the dog. So, the important point is that actually it is determined by what we remember at the time of death. But what we remember at the time of death is also determined by what we have remembered throughout our life, what have been our desires throughout our life. So anyway, the important point in this discussion is that the relationship between the body and the soul shouldn't be given too much emphasis. It's actually peripheral. It is not an eternal relationship. It is a temporary relationship. So this is something which many traditions do not understand. Like we were earlier discussing about the Abrahamic religions. So the clear understanding of the soul as an ontological, concrete, higher dimensional entity, the clear understanding of that soul is not there that way. And because of that, there is some sign of conflation, a mixing up of the soul and the body. And in some of these traditions, the idea is that they bury the body because somehow the idea is that at the time of judgment, eventually when people will be taken back to heaven, they will all be taken back at the time when in the body that they have right now. So the idea is the body that we have right now is the body that we will have in heaven for all the time to come. So now, because there is no clear understanding of the difference between the body and the soul, and that's why some people have the idea that the body has to be preserved in a coffin when it is buried. Now, of course, even if you preserve it in a coffin, the body doesn't stay. And actually, not only does the body doesn't stay, all the particles that made the body, they get destroyed. And they may all be in different bodies now. So, it's a little simplistic idea that the body and the soul are somehow eternal, and in the kingdom of God, we will have the same body that we have right now. And of course, this poses various serious problems. That if a person is born with, say, a crippled or a blind or a deformed body, and that's the body that the person has, will that person have the same body throughout all of eternity? That would be hell. Or if a child, if some people say, no, the person will have a young, youthful, healthy body. But then you may get the question, but then what if somebody dies before the person becomes youthful and healthy? What kind of body will the person have at that time? Will it be the body that the person may have got when the person grew up? How do we know that? What kind of body that person will have? So actually speaking, the whole understanding here is based on a too strong a misidentification or a conflation between the body and the soul. And when people have a bodily conception of life, then even if there is religion, and there is religious belief, still that religious belief can also be misunderstood. There are some atheists who say that religion is extremely dangerous because there are these terrorists, jihadis, and they become suicide bombers and they are ready to destroy themselves. And why are they ready to destroy themselves? Because they have been brainwashed into believing that, oh, we will enjoy with 73 virgins in heaven, in Jannah, for all time to come. And that's why what's wrong in dying once if you're going to eternal life and eternal enjoyment? So the atheists argue that, see how dangerous religious belief is. Nothing else will make a person become a suicide bomber like this, and not in such large numbers. So religion contaminates the human mind with such dangerous imaginations that people are ready to kill others in the hope of some imaginary pleasure in the future life. So, is this the effect of belief in afterlife? Actually, any belief can have any effect depending on how it is interpreted. So, actually, the problem here is not afterlife. The problem is material conception of life. It's the fundamental difference between the two. See, afterlife means that there is some life after this. So, the problem here, it's not that all people who believe in afterlife will become jihadis. You know, there are so many people who have believed throughout history in reincarnation, in future lives, and afterlife in general. But how many of them have become militants? So actually, what causes a person to develop this kind of ideas is a material conception of life. Because of the material conception of life, people think that, okay, enjoyment means sensual enjoyment. And I'm not getting sensual enjoyment. In the future, I'll get sensual enjoyment. And therefore, let me do this. Let me become a suicide bomber. And in future, I'll be able to enjoy. So, the point is, the clear understanding of the difference between the body and the soul ensures that the person doesn't continue in a material conception of life. And when the person doesn't continue in the material conception of life, the person acquires a spiritual conception of life. That actually real enjoyment is not just in sensuality. It is in loving service. It's in love and service. And love and service centered in God and connected with all living beings. So, if the belief in afterlife is based on a simplistic whitewashing of the future as immaterial enjoyable, based on some belief system, then that can be perverted. But when the entry in the future life is dependent on a thorough re-education of our head and a redirection of our heart, then that means from matter to God, then this sort of misunderstandings will never happen. So these are disastrous misunderstandings, and that way if we see, any belief system can be distorted. The world's greatest killers in recent times were, if you see, they were Mao Zedong in China, Stalin in Russia, and such people, if we see, they were the biggest killers, and they were atheists. They were atheists. So actually, atheism itself has that. Hitler was an atheist. And he killed so many millions of people. So actually speaking, if we look at it, the religion, if it's properly understood, it tells us that life is sacred. And because life is sacred, it must be valued. Whereas atheism, it says that life is a chance product. And then if enjoyment in this life is the goal, then what is the point in doing anything which will obstruct that enjoyment? What is the point in preserving anything? So morality obstructs the enjoyment. Put it aside and just enjoy. So actually, it's not reincarnation or afterlife. It's a material conception of life that causes problems. And here we see that material conception of life is removed, it's shattered by the Bhagavad Gita right in the beginning, when it describes that we are different from the body. We are actually souls. And Prabhupada again quotes the verse about the two birds in the purport to illustrate how the soul's journey takes place from one body to another by the guidance of the super soul. Now let's look at the next verse. Nainam chindanti shastrani, nainam dahati pavakaha, na chainam klidayantyapo, na shoshayati marutaha. So, na enam, not this. Chindanti is penetrated by shastrani. The soul is not penetrated by, soul is not destroyed by weapons. The soul is not dahati pavakaha, burned by fire. The soul is not kledayantyapo, is not watered away. It is not destroyed by, dissolved by water. Na kshoshayati marutaha, it is not withered away by the wind. So essentially, what is the emphasis of these four statements? It is that the things which destroy the body, things which harm the body, do not harm the soul. That is the important point. So again and again, Krishna is driving home the point that the soul is indestructible. So in continuing resonance with the previous verse, the point is that just as when you discard the dress and you take a new dress, the person remains unharmed in the process. So similarly, when the person discards the body and goes to a new body, the person will remain unharmed. So when Arjuna is going to shoot the arrows, at that time, the soul is going to be unharmed, the soul will go to the next body. So the soul is not going to be destroyed by any weapons. So Prabhupada explains in the purport about how there are different kinds of weapons which the Vedic literature talks about. So today we have lots of weapons of mass destruction, and these are extremely dangerous in many ways. But these are considered to be enormously powerful, extremely destructive. You know, after the World War II, in which the atom bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, after that there have been further many weapons developed. In fact, America developed a weapon and they tested it on an island. And then this weapon was many times more powerful than the bomb that fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the result of that explosion was that it exploded on the island and the whole island disappeared from the world map. It was just shattered, and what the shattered debris just sunk into the ocean. So the destruction of the weapon obliterated the whole island from the world map. So we have weapons of tremendous destructive power. Now, these weapons are there in today's times. In the past, there are other weapons. So we had the Brahmastra, we had the Suryastra, there are many weapons like that. So that is also technology, this is also technology. Is there any difference between the two? It's a major difference. The difference is that the technology today is in untrained hands. Often it is in hands that are irresponsible. You know, the more dangerous the weapons that, say, terrorists have, the greater terror they will cause. So in the Vedic culture, to ensure that the weapons would not be in the hands of people who could cause such terrible destruction. So and the Kshatriyas would have skills in fighting, and they would fight, but they were trained so that they will act in a responsible way. And the Kshatatrayate, Prabhupada will say in the purport, Kshatatrayate, those who protect from hurt, they are called as Kshatriyas. That's what they are meant to do. So unless there is proper training, the use of that is invention or the development of weapons can lead to enormous damage in society. Now Prabhupada explains in the purport how there are different kinds of weapons. See, the current idea of weapons is, the way today's weapons, say atomic weapons are developed, is that the whole process involves understanding there's a lot of energy within an atom. So by a process we tap that energy, and when you tap that energy, then that can be used for peaceful purposes or it can be used for destructive purposes. There are a lot of energy within the nucleus also that can also be used. So either way, the important point is that these weapons are used for by manipulating things at atomic level. So the primary kind of energy that we know about is based on radiations. And in the elemental theory of matter, earth, water, fire, air, ether, radiation, electromagnetic waves, they fall in fire. So Prabhupada says most of the weapons that we know about today are fire weapons. But there are different kinds of weapons. So for example, if somebody wanted to destroy a village, so you could drop a bomb on it. Or that person, imagine if a tornado comes over there. A tornado can also destroy that village. Now of course we may say that, oh, and a tornado is a force of nature. We cannot cause a tornado. Yes, that is true. We cannot cause a tornado. But when a tornado comes, it's not just a chance force of nature. There are factors involved, which involve karmic causality. Those people have done some karma and they are getting the reactions. But anyway, even the movement of the wind is controlled by the devatas. So, just as those who control the devatas can cause a tornado, similarly, they can give the power to cause something like a tornado for those who do the appropriate kinds of tapasya and worship. So that means here we understand that there is jiva, there is prakriti, there is jiva. So prakriti is material nature, jiva is we living entities. So now we living entities can manipulate prakriti. We can manipulate prakriti for various purposes. You can use it for good purposes or we can use it for bad purposes. So we manipulate it using technology. Now when we use it with our technology, say we make some atomic weapons or something like that, we are trying to understand the principles from a reductionistic point of view. Reductionistic means we reduce the whole universe down to particles and forces operating according to laws. So we try to get power over that and we try to control nature. So that is one way of looking at it. But other way is that we understand that there is a hierarchy in the universe and the matter is controlled by devatas, and those devatas also have powers which are far greater than what we have. And when devatas use that power, they can use it for doing their universal functions. But if we satisfy them, so in this hierarchy of prakriti and jiva, in the jiva there is hierarchy of jivas. We have certain level of control over prakriti and we can use our intelligence to increase that power if we want. That's what we try to do with technology. But there are other jivas who have greater control over prakriti. And when those jivas, they gain control, and then they already have control by the power of nature. And when we satisfy them, by satisfying them, by doing certain rituals, by doing certain tapasya, by religious practices, then they give us that power. When they give us that power, then similarly we are able to control material nature. So when we say that there is a Vayu Astra, a weapon which causes a tornado, like a storm to come, then we may say, this is all mythology. How can you can take out an arrow and that causes storm? No, it's not mythology. There are subtle principles involved. And the principle is that actually there is a devata in charge of Vayu. And if we invoke that devata, if we please that devata and got that astra, then that astra can enable us to do that. So like that, the living entity can try to control matter in different ways. One is independently of any higher controller, higher knowledge or higher purpose. Or it can be in cooperation with the higher purposes, with the higher power, higher beings. So either way, the important point is that none of these weapons can ever destroy the soul. There have been many different weapons throughout history. In the future, there may be different weapons. But the important point is none of those weapons can destroy the soul. Now, why they can't destroy the soul? That is described in the next verse. Achedyo yamadhayo yam akledyo shoshevacha nitya sarvagatah sthanur achalo yam sanatanaha. So, achedyo yam. So here in the 24a and b, four characteristics are described which explain the four statements of 23. So for example, you know, water cannot dissolve. If I say that if I got some pill and it's say put in a capsule, if I got some medicine in a capsule and I put it in water, say that water will not dissolve this. So it will not dissolve in water. Why? Because it is insoluble. So like that, in the previous verse, assertion is made, and in this verse, a characteristic of the soul is described, which brings about that, which explains that assertion. So, nainam chinnanti shastrani, the soul cannot be penetrated. Why? Because achedyoyam, it is impenetrable. Nainam dahati pavaka, the soul cannot be burned, because it is adahayoyam, it is not inflammable. It has a character that can't be burned. Then Nainam Kledayantyapo is akledyoyam. So the soul cannot be dried away, it cannot be withered away. So these are the characteristics which explain what has been told in the previous verse. And after that, you should also discuss Nityaha, eternally, as talked about earlier. Sarvagataha. Sarvagataha is the soul is present everywhere. So now again, what does this mean? Does it mean that the soul is all pervading? Now it's very clear that Krishna has stated, he's talking about the body. And if he is in the previous verse talked about how the soul goes from one body to another body, how the soul actually is in, just the soul, just we have one dress and we give up one dress and take up another dress. Similarly, the soul gives up one body and acquires another body. Now, if the soul were sarvagataha in the sense of being everywhere, then what is the point of the saying that the soul will give up one body and take another body? The whole point of saying that it will give up one body and another body, that implies the soul is going from here to there, the soul is acquiring another body. There is no point in, if the soul is already all pervading, then what is the point of saying the soul will give up one body and take another body? It's like saying that the person is already wearing all dresses, the person is already there everywhere. So what is the point of giving up one dress and taking another dress? So sarvagataha, if we see, that's what Srila Prabhupada explains. He follows the Acharya Kuldevi Devabhushan Chakravarti Pad over here, and he explained that sarvagataha is not to be taken literally as meaning that the soul is all pervading, but the soul is capable of going everywhere. And sarvagataha means the soul is capable of living everywhere. So Prabhupada uses this to say that how there is life on other planets also. The soul is there in every species, in various species, in bodies that are suitable to the climates, atmospheric situations in different places. So how is this possible? Now, all that an honest scientist can say is that life as we know it is not possible on other planets. That means that how can scientists infer that there is no life on other planets? They may say, oh, there is no oxygen over there, there is no water over there, the temperature is too high over there. So based on this, they may say that, okay, life is not possible over there. So now all that this means is, we are assuming that life requires oxygen, life requires a particular temperature range, life requires a particular, material items like, say, water. Only the life can survive. But this is not necessary. In the previous verses, Krishna has told that the soul is the source of consciousness. The soul is not destructive, destroyable by anything material. So therefore, the soul can, if it gets the appropriate bodies for being in a particular locale, in a particular environment, the soul can stay in that locale. So if the soul is, say, in the vicinity of the sun, planet, then there the sun will, there it will get a body that is primarily made of fire and it will survive in that place also. Even from the modern scientific point of view, all that can be said is that life as we know it doesn't exist. So there are some scientists who have proposed that, scientists claim to have gone to the moon and they say that we didn't find any life over there. But then the question arises, some scientists have said that we have not really searched beyond the surface of the moon. What about under the surface of the moon? There will be life over there, deep buried. We have found lots of forms of life. They are called as extremophiles. Extremophiles means they live in extreme conditions. Phil means to love. Extreme is severe, extreme conditions. So, for example, there are life forms which survive in extremely hot situations. So, they are called as, say, fire bacteria, for example. These survive in such hot conditions in which humans can't conceive of surviving. What to speak of human beings? Most living beings can't survive. The extremophiles, In fact, when the temperature decreases, it becomes too cold for them to live. So the temperatures at which we will find them intolerably hot, they find those temperatures to be intolerably cold. So similarly, the deep within the ocean's body, actually, there are organisms, not just microscopic organisms, but visible organisms who live breathing in nitrogen dioxide. And they basically get their nourishment from the rocks that are there in the ocean bed. So this was inconceivable. But extremophiles, more and more extremophiles are being discovered by researchers. And this indicates that actually things are not as simple as we have been led to believe when we talk about life on other planets. So if we assume that life has to be like this, like this, like this, like this, then when we find that, then we may say that, okay, these conditions are not there, so life is not there. But if we find out that actually there are no conditions required for life, in the sense that in any environment, the soul can acquire appropriate body suitable for that environment, get nourishment from that environment and continue to live, then sarvagata is entirely possible. And so Prabhupada would use a simpler logic also. He said that if we look at the earth, we see that life is crowding everywhere. You can look at a small crack on the earth, and the crack is filled with some ants and insects and things like that. So, when so much life is there everywhere, in a small crack of space on the earth, a small crack in the earth, you know, there are thousands of planets. Why would God do such a waste of space? There are so many planets. Why would just God create them and leave them as it is? So God is an efficient designer, and He would do things in such a way that they are productive. So sarvagataha, soul is capable of living everywhere. Sthanu, unchangeable. So unchangeable can have various meanings. In the context, what it means over here is that Prabhupada, this can be used as well as the future verses can also be used to explain that the soul does not undergo the changes. You know, we see Akshara will be talked about next in the future also. So, the soul does not undergo the changes, the body undergoes. Now, Achala, what does Achala mean? Now, Achala means immovable. We know the mind is said to be Chanchala. Rasla, Chanchala Mahimanaha Krishna. Krishna tells to Arjuna, in 6.34, that mind, I can't control this. It's impossible. So, chanchala, the mind is restless. But Krishna is saying the soul is achala. It is immovable. It is not restless. So now, does this immovability mean complete, permanent, absolute immovability? Again, if you are meaning that, and the whole point of the soul giving up one body and going to another body, that would have no meaning. And Krishna tells also later in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 14th chapter, he talks about Urdhvam gacchanti sattvastha madhye tishtanti rajasah yaganya gunavattistha adho gacchanti tamasah. So Krishna says that those who live in goodness, they go upwards. Those who live in passion stay over here only, and those who live in ignorance go downwards. Now such statements would have no meaning if the soul were immovable. If the soul were absolutely immovable, then what is the point in saying that the soul will go up or the soul will go down or the soul will go in this arena itself? So what it means is, Achala means the soul cannot be moved by anything material. So the soul can be moved only by its own will. When the Atma is to be taken from one body to another. For example, when Yamadutas come, and the Yamadutas are to catch the person and drag the person away. So, what do they do? The Yamapasha is material. The Yamapasha cannot catch the soul. The Yamapasha catches the subtle body. And the Yamadutas drag the subtle body out. And the soul is attached to the subtle body. And because the soul is attached to the subtle body, the soul goes with the subtle body to wherever the soul is to wherever the subtle body is taken. So, for example, to understand this, you can say that if a person is watching, say, a match on TV, a cricket match is going on, a person is completely attached to watching the TV match. And then suppose some thieves come along. And a thieves come along, a thief just pick up the TV and go away. And this person keeps watching the TV and goes along with the thieves. So like that, basically the Yamadutas come and take the subtle body, and because soul is hooked up the subtle body, soul also goes along with it. So achaloyam, so sanatanaha, so soul is immovable and is eternal. Now Prabhupada uses here the masculine gender for the soul, several places. He uses the word he in several places. Now this is just a conventional use, it is not referring to the soul's gender per se. In some other places, soul may use the word lit, it also. The living entity is and it goes. So now soul uses, now the soul, the reference to the masculine for the soul is just conventional. In the, for most of history, actually he was used as a reference for everyone. The male was an inclusive reference for all of humanity. But due to the trends of modernity and postmodernity, you know, often now the he is considered as a reference to males, and therefore many times when we talk, we use he or she, or sometimes she or he. So this is just a reference based on total concurrent conventions. But he itself was not meant to, he earlier was in all inclusive. So man is, so for example, if we say that man is the maker of his own destiny. So if that is the case, then doesn't that man includes woman in it? So earlier the he, masculine gender, the male was considered inclusive. And so Prabhupada wrote the books when the masculine gender was inclusive. So this is not referring to the, wherever in this section, Prabhupada refers to the soul in masculine. That is just a reference to the all living beings in a generic inclusive sense of the use of the word he. The soul is actually having no gender, it is neither masculine nor feminine. The soul is transcendental. Of course, in the spiritual world the soul has a swarupa, and in that swarupa the soul is, does have some form. So that may also be a particular gender. The gopis are female gender, the gopas are male gender. But that is completely spiritual and transcendental. So here, the he is used in an inclusive sense, not in a specific sense of belonging to a particular gender. The soul is transcendental. Now, Krishna gives some further descriptions of the soul. Avyaktoyam achintyoyam avikaryoyam uchyate tasmadevam viditvainam nanushochitum arhasi. So, avyaktoyam. Avyakta means the soul is, as Prabhupada says, invisible or unmanifest. So we can't perceive the soul with our senses. We can't perceive the soul with our gross sensory faculties. Then, achintyoyam. The soul is also inconceivable. If the soul is inconceivable, achintyoyam, then how can we conceive it? In fact, we could say that what is the need to conceive it also? Let me just live happily in the body, the conception of life. Let me not bother about the soul business. But the point is that unless we think about the soul, we cannot understand what life is ultimately meant for. Because life at the level of the body will soon be destroyed. It will be terminated. So, achintyoyam. Achintyoyam, Prabhupada explains, it means inconceivable, means that we cannot really conceive the soul by our own independent endeavors. We need scriptural guidance. With our logical inference, we can think of something about the soul. We can get some understanding of the soul. But if you want deeper understanding, we need to look at the tradition, at the scriptural tradition, and therein we get an understanding. So achintya doesn't mean entirely inconceivable. It simply means that it's not conceivable by our independent speculation. We get some indication, but for a deeper understanding, we need scripture. Avikaryoyam uchyate. Avikarya. Vikar is change. So, sthanu was also unchangeable. So, here Prabhupada explains that vikar refers to the six changes that the body undergoes. That is creation, then there is growth, then there is reproduction, then there is maintenance, preservation, then there is deterioration, and then there is destruction. So these six changes the body undergoes, but the soul does not undergo in the changes. Abhikaryoyam uchyate. And tasmad evam viditvainam. So knowing the soul to be thus, nanushochitum arhasi, do not lament, do not lament. Now Krishna will talk about this. We will see this nanushochitum arhasi, na shochitum. This will come again and again in this section. In fact, this has already come once in avinashitad vidhi yena sarvamidam tatam vinasham avyasyasya na kashchit kartum arhati. So when Krishna had talked about that, the soul cannot be destroyed. At that time also he had told Arjuna, therefore Arjuna, do not lament. That he has talked about this, do not lament, earlier in 2.13 when he said dhiras tatrana mohiyati. So what he has talked about, now he'll make it more emphatic. So this first time nanushochitum arhati, it'll come several times in this section. So what is the connection of the first part and the second part? For first part, actually the soul is avikarya. It is not going to grow old. It is not going to grow die. It is not going to be young. It's always the same. So Prabhupada explains, Bhishma and Drona, for whom Arjuna is concerned, they are going to get new bodies. You know, they will either get spiritual bodies if they are liberated, which is what is going to happen to them when they die in Krishna's presence, or they will get elevated bodies based on their overall karma. And so if their old bodies go away, new bodies come on. That is, then what is the cause for lamentation in that? Then after this, now after talking about how the soul gets a new body, Krishna briefly talks about the philosophy which rejects the soul. Atachainam nityajatam nityam vamanyasevratam tathapi tvam mahapaho nainam shochitum arhasi. So atha cha enam, if however nityajatam, the soul is always born, nityam vamanyasevratam, then it is always destroyed. Atapi tvam mahabaho, therefore even then, O Arjuna, nainam shochitum arhasi. So I said the same point is being repeated, and the conclusion is, don't lament, don't do shoka. So what does it mean? Here Krishna is talking about the atheistic, the reductionistic philosophies that were present at that time, and there are philosophies present like that even today which claim that actually life begins with chemical combination at time of birth, and when there is chemical iteration, life is destroyed. So this school of thought reduces life to just a set of biochemicals which live for some time and which die thereafter. So this kind of understanding of life as just a set of biochemicals that has come alive, this is today promoted in the name of science. However, science has never been able to produce life from biochemicals. There have been experiments which claim to have produced artificial life, but if we look at seriously at what has been done, it's not artificial life. It's simply manipulation of real life to bring about something else which is slightly modified. So nowadays many research institutes, in order to attract funds and in order to gain prestige, use spin doctors. Spin doctors means that these are media experts who know how to phrase things in such a way that will catch attention. So because of that, when they use such words, artificial life created, and it catches attention. But actually, if we see what has been done, it's not artificial life creation. It's simply, basically, for example, they may take the, I have written an article about this on my website. The whole point is, they may just take some DNA from an existing setup, and then they replicate the DNA, and they put the DNA, they make some modification in that, maybe slightly change it, and then let the thing grow, and then their life emerges. So now they say that we have created artificial life, but basically the structure through which life has come, that only they have modified. But how life comes about, that is not really known. So it's like music. You know, if I have a soundtrack on which music is there, and then I replay the sound comes. Now if I take the soundtrack and I just change it a little bit and place it on some other medium, then on that medium, the sound plays slightly differently. So now, the soundtrack is definitely connected with the sound. But the soundtrack has not originated. So the sound has not just originated from the soundtrack. The sound was spoken by somebody. And the sound is heard by somebody. So the soundtrack is the medium through which the sound comes. And the soundtrack can be manipulated and changed slightly so that the sound can become changed. By soundtrack, I am referring here to the physical medium, whatever medium it is, on which the sound is stored. So that can be, now this is an example that is given by a prominent biologist in his book called The Music of Life. So similarly, the body is the medium through which consciousness is expressed. So for example, in certain microscopic organisms, they grow in a particular way. So now if we change the genetics a little bit, then they may grow in a different way. But either way, the consciousness is not just present in the biochemical arrangement. Just as the music is not originated in the soundtrack. The music is originated from a person who spoke the music. And the music is understood by some other person. The soundtrack is simply the medium through which the music is transmitted. And the medium is changed, the soundtrack can get changed. So what researchers do is simply the biochemical structure like DNA or whatever which they use for their experiments. So those are originally produced by nature, and then when they are slightly modified, at that time life may come out in slightly different ways. So this is a very simple example I'm giving. We don't want to go into science class over here. So, but those who are interested, they can read the relevant articles on my site. But the important point is, actually, this whole idea that life comes from chemicals doesn't have even scientific basis, or to speak of philosophical basis. So these are grand claims. These are claims done by spin doctors. Spin doctors means media experts, media managers who want to get big publicity. So, but Krishna is saying, even if somebody thinks that life is just a bunch of chemicals, then this, even then you should not lament. So why should one not lament? Now, Prabhupada explains that here Krishna is also using the word Mahabaho because he wants to indicate to Arjuna that, Arjuna, I know that you are a person who is born in a great culture, you are a great warrior. You will not be overcome by such petty misconceptions. Now, jatasya hidruo mrityur dhruvam janma mrityasya cha tasmada parihari erthe natvam shochitum arhasi. So jatasya hidruo mrityur. So now if one thinks that either way that there is no body, there is no only body, no soul, but still we know that's a universal fact that whoever is born has to die. Jatasya dhruva mrityu. Dhruva, it's a certain fact. Similarly, dhruvam janma mrityasya. Similarly, actually, once we accept the reincarnation of the soul, then we understand that one who is, after that one is going to get the body. Tasmada parihariyarthe natvam shochitum harasi. So the connection between this and the previous verse is that if we just consider life to be a bunch of chemicals, then why lament? That actually chemicals are existing everywhere, and by the principle of conservation of energy, none of the chemicals are permanently destroyed. All that happens is that their form is just temporarily changed. So they were in the form of a person right now, as conscious. Now they have just become a lump of ashes. So why lament? But Krishna, Arjuna, you don't have that kind of belief. So jatas, everyone who is born who has to die. So even if you don't fight this battle, your elders are going to die. And they are going to get a next birth also. So rather than giving up your duty to avoid that which is unavoidable, you do your duty and thereby you will attain an auspicious destination. So by giving up your duty, you cannot avoid the unavoidable. Death is going to come to everyone. Therefore, do your duty. So, natvam shochitum arhasi. And Krishna says, all things are अव्यक्तादीनि भूतानि व्यक्तमध्यानि भारत अव्यक्तनिधनान्येव तत्र का परिदेवना. सो अव्यक्त आदीनि भूतानि, इनिशियली एवरीथिंग इज अनमैनिफेस्ट. व्यक्तमध्यानि भारत, then they become, everything is unmanifest, and it becomes manifest, and then again it becomes manifest, unmanifest. So therefore, what is the cause for lamentation? That means, as far as chemicals are concerned, if the body is just a lump of chemicals, then they are initially not alive, and now they become alive temporarily, and then after that they die. So chemical transformation is constantly happening, and if life is just reduced to chemicals, then all emotions ultimately become meaningless. And ultimately, everything becomes meaningless. That who, you know, when a mother loves the child, why does the mother love the child? Oh, actually, just some chemicals are secreted in the brain. And because those chemicals are secreted in the brain of the mother, that's why the mother loves the child. So we reduce love down to just chemical secretion. So is that really love? Is that all that love is, just some chemical secretion? Not at all. Love is something far deeper and richer. So if it is just chemicals, then why should we lament? Ultimately, everything is destructible. It is temporary there with us. It is unavoidable change. So essential message of Krishna to Arjuna is Tatraka Paridevana. Why do you lament, to Arjuna? So now, Krishna is going to talk and conclude this section in the next two verses, which we'll discuss in our next class. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.